The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Ready for action, nip it in the bud, we never relaxing. Outcast is everlasting, not clashing, not at all. But see, my nigga went to do a little acting. Now that's for anyone asking, give me one, pass them. Drip, drip, drop, there it goes an orgasm. Now you coming out the side of your face, we tapping right into your memory bank. Thanks. So click at the ticket, let's see your seatbelt fastened. Trunk rattling, like 2 minutes in the back seat wrestling. Speaker box vibrate the tag, make it sound like aluminum cans in a bag. But I know y'all wanted that 808, can you feel that BASS, babe? But I know y'all wanted that 808, can you feel that BASS, babe?
That is the multiple Grammy Award winning hip hop group Outkast. Their brand of wordplay, gospel, and funk redefined the sounds of the South in the mid-90s and crossed over to mainstream audiences in the early 2000s. While their impact on hip-hop is undeniable, a college professor thinks the duo's relevance transcends the genre. Regina Bradley is assistant professor of African American Lit at Armstrong State University in Savannah, Georgia. She designed an upper-class English course called Teaching Outkast and the Rise of the Hip-Hop South, which is happening this semester. Dr. Bradley, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me. Yay, I didn't want you to turn off the music.
Boy, I wonder what class must be like.
I'm telling you.
Well, you are a longtime fan of the group, but how would you describe the band to someone who doesn't know them?
I would be like, you don't know Outkast? That'd be my first response. Second response would be, so Outkast is one of the most iconic Southern hip-hop groups, and they're iconic, one, because of their music, but also because they were the first recognized Southern hip-hop group in the early 1990s to kind of break through. You know, it wasn't like a, hey, welcome. It was, they were literally booed off the stage at the Source Awards in 1995. So they paid their dues.
Well, why? Because Southern hip hop was not yet recognized?
Well, because a lot of folks, especially folks in New York, thought there was no such thing as Southern hip hop, let alone any kind of hip hop outside of New York. But, yeah, I mean, like, they fought to be recognized not only as a legit hip-hop group, but also they talked about things that were relevant to Southern folks. And a lot of the issues and concerns that they were talking about didn't translate in the same way as they did for New York. So if you were from the South and you're talking about Atlanta, which at that point was not known as the transient city that it is today, it was on the cusp, if you will, then, of course, they're like, oh, Atlanta's still country and it's backwards and Black folks in the South, they don't know anything about hip-hop because hip-hop is considered urban and slick and full of wordplay.
Well, and they really made it. There's this song, which is now, I would say, a staple at weddings and home dance parties. That's Hey Ya by the band Outkast, and we're talking about a class that our guest Regina Bradley, an assistant professor of African American Lit at Armstrong State University, is teaching this semester. Well, Regina, you mentioned the regionalism, that Outkast is from the South, but what makes this band worth studying?
Well, I think it's really fascinating how they move their ideas and articulation of Southernness out. So when you first introduce to them on their first album, which is titled Southern Playlistic Cadillac Music, they're talking about the city of Atlanta, and Atlanta is kind of central to their idea of the South. And then on their second album, which is ATLians, they start to move away from that kind of geographically located idea of Southernness. And then also are kind of clapping back, if you will, at being rejected at the Source Awards. So they have ATLians, and then when they get to Aquemini and the Stankonia and eventually Speaker Box Love Below, their ideas of Southernness is more of a cultural concept. instead of something that's geographically located, which often when we have these conversations about Southernness, we kind of try to stick to the physical region of the South. But what OutKast does so beautifully, and also with really great experimentation, is that they move or force the audience to reconsider what they think Southernness is using their music.
The Pope and the Scopes got us under the scope, but for unknown reasons, because we don't sell dope that you distribute, we don't contribute to your clandestine activity. My soliloquy may be hard for some to swallow, but so is Carl Liveroy. You went behind my back like Ludo when he cut up all the boar. Two things I hate, lies and thieves, they make my blood boil. But we're constricted on my soul that they call wheels of steel.
You see that transition really well, kind of marking through their catalog as it develops.
Speaker Box Love Below, that is a double album that, did that one win the Album of the Year Grammy?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember.
It was the first rap album to win Album of the Year back
huge,
in 2004.
Huge success. Have you had a lot of students sign up?
We currently have 20 students. The class was full by the second day of registration. So I'm like, y'all love me. Y'all really love me.
Now, would anybody who doesn't know the band want to take it?
So I do have a couple of students who are like, I have never heard of OutKast. So I'm like, oh, so you really took the class because you love me, right? ultimately what it is it's a popular culture studies class using literature as kind of the foregrounding for that analysis. So I have students who are like, I don't really listen to OutKast or I don't really listen to hip-hop, but they wanted to come in and try something different. They wanted to kind of see what all the hubbub was about. And I think that's really great. And I also try to make sure that those students are comfortable when we have these conversations as well.
One of the things that I hear in the band is a kind of vulnerability and openness about love and respect for women, at least in their later work. I'm thinking of the song Mrs. Jackson, which is about the mother of Andre 3000's partner, Erykah Badu. After they broke up, he's apologizing to her. So how do you think they fit in with those frequently well-deserved charges of misogyny in hip-hop?
So Dr. Treva Lindsay has a term that I absolutely fell in love with when she told me. It's called melodious misogyny, which means that there's these really horrible things that are being said about women, but it sounds so good, so we'll give it a pass, right? And I'm not here to say that OutKast is perfect. By far, they're not. They definitely have misogynistic moments, and it might be that kind of lower-level misogyny. But what I really can appreciate about them, and this is something that I write about in my book, is that you can see a development of their ideas and attitudes towards women shift, right? So if you look at Southern Playlistic, Cadillac Music, and you look at ATLian's Jazzy Bell, for example, there's a particular type of respectability that black women have to have that they were seeing, or that they felt that a lot of young Southern black women didn't have. And then you have, like you were pointing out, in Stankonia with Miss Jackson, so now you have families, right? This is the post-Badu moment for Andre. And you can kind of see that influence. Big Boy has a daughter now. He's married, right? So you can see that kind of influence. And then when you think about the Love Below, it's almost like it's an existential question of where Andre fits into the experiences of black women, because he samples his mother. He interviews his mother. He talks about God if God was a woman. He talks about all of these things that focus on the experiences of black women, and probably most importantly, uses their voices to do so.
I was scuffling going to school, I was scuffling and working at night. And you know what? I truly believe, and that's why I tell a lot of parents, single parents, don't tell me what God can't do. I made sure you had. I never felt like you should be deprived of anything. If a man didn't want to take care of his child, you move on. And that's what I did. I moved on.
It's interesting, you know, that kind of continuous development of what they think of where women fit into their own narratives, but also allowing room for women to speak for themselves, literally speak for themselves on their albums is really important.
So this is a hip-hop band that crossed over, right? So what does that do for the understanding of the band? Or does it take away anything in your mind?
Well, one thing that I think about is when they did their reunion tour in 2014, their first performance was at Coachella. And I was so bummed that I couldn't go because Coachella.
Sunshine, California, spring, great outfits.
Yep, and a whole lot of money to get there.
Right.
And they went through their entire catalog. They went from album to album to album. And the one thing that I saw as I was watching, because clearly I had it on my, you know, full speaker blast system in my house, listening like I was at Coachella. But after they performed Speaker Box and The Love Below, which they hadn't done because they stopped touring after that album, people started leaving. And I was like, what are you doing? Why are you leaving? Because folks weren't familiar with anything really before Speaker Box and The Love Below and Hey Ya and I Like the Way You Move, right? And I think that that's particularly important, how they're being remembered in popular culture. And it's unfortunate if that's the starting point for a lot of folks, which it really is, because arguably, I mean, they had crossed over before, but I mean, the Duo album made them a pop culture sensation. Like, everybody's like, oh, it's Outkast. But it's kind of unfortunate because they did so much great work beforehand. And I think that that part of their legacy is kind of overlooked in favor of the Grammy Award-winning Outkast.
My relationship with my folks is give and take, and I done took so much, not giving my glory. To have a choice to be who you wants to be is left over to me, and my mama damn told me.
Dr. Regina Bradley is with us. She's teaching a course about the hip-hop duo Outkast at Armstrong State University in Savannah. So this is American Studies course, and you said this is the literature of Outkast. So what's on your syllabus? Are you breaking apart, deconstructing songs?
Yeah, so one of the first activities that we do in every class is they do a critical listening activity. So I pick a song from the album that we're focusing on for that unit, and we listen to it, and they break down the lyrics, they break down the musical accompaniment, they break down if they hear ad-libs, if they hear silence, you know, kind of, you know, what do these things signify, and what are they trying to do in order to present a particular type of message. So that is the pop cultural part. The literary part is they're actually looking at contemporary Southern Black writers who have said in previous interviews that they have been influenced by Outkast music. So for example, we are looking at Key S.A. Lehman's novel, Long Division, and the opening of that novel starts with a lyric from Andre 3000 in the album Aquemini.
Twice upon a time, there was a boy who died and lived happily ever after, but that's another chapter live from.
So particular songs, we'll listen to those and think about, you know, this idea of storytelling and how Outkast interpretation of storytelling can be extended into critically analyzing what Key S.A. Lehman is doing in his novel. We're also looking at Jesmyn Ward and her novel Where the Line Bleeds, mm-hmm. And that also points to Southern hip-hop. And we also have critical part of it, because it is an upper-level English seminar. We're looking at Dr. Zandria Robinson's book, This Ain't Chicago, which is her theorization from a sociology perspective of what it means to be in the South and be Black after the Civil Rights Movement. She calls it the post-soul South. So it's really interesting in kind of connecting those things together. And we are finishing the semester with Stankonia and Speaker Box, The Love Below, and thinking about how their influence has influenced other Southern popular culture representations of Blackness. So Donald Glover's Atlanta, for example. Mm-hmm. So we'll be looking at Atlanta, looking at the visualization of what some of those things look like, and also looking at their film Outwild. So trying to cover almost all the bases. You can only do so much in one semester, but at least kind of showing students it's more than just the music. There's an actual cultural impact that this group has had in very profound ways.
Well, I will listen to them much differently, and Regina, I thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed our conversation.
Regina Bradley, she's a writer, researcher, and assistant professor at Armstrong State University, where she is currently teaching Outkast and the Rise of the Hip-Hop South. There's more on the class and a link to her Outkasted Conversations podcast. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Deadlines can be stressful, but for many artistic types and tinkerers and perfectionists and radio producers, they can also be motivational. As in, if you do not have a deadline, you will never know if something is finished. That is part of the idea behind a number of creative community-based challenges that have grown popular over the years. NaNoWriMo, or National Novel Writing Month in November, which we've talked about on this program. The 48-hour film project, exactly what it sounds like. And another event created right here in New Hampshire, RPM, or the Record Production Month Challenge, which officially begins on February 1st. And producer Taylor Quimby is going to be following one of the musicians who's going to be taking up the challenge. But first, he's here to tell us a little about the challenge itself. Hello, Taylor.
Hello, and I'm just going to test my levels here real quick because I'm also playing engineer right now. But hi, hello.
Oh, Taylor, thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Of course.
So one album, 1 month. That's it.
That is exactly the idea, that you write, record, and mix an album in the 28 days of February.
And an album equals what? Like how many songs?
So their rules are either 10 songs or 35 minutes. So if you're in like a prog rock band, you could do like one 35-minute song. Or you could get away with doing 10 one-minute super fast pop tracks or something like that. And this event is actually in its 12th year. So back when it started, you had to mail a CD physically into the RPM organization when you were finished.
So nostalgic.
I know. Nowadays, you still can mail the CD, but you can also Dropbox your finished album. And I actually spoke to Dave Karlotsky. He's one of the co-organizers, and he told me a little bit about how this whole thing got started.
When we originally started RPM, it was an offshoot of The Wire, the weekly paper that we put out here on the Seacoast. And so it was a natural sort of extension of the kinds of arts advocacy that we were always involved in. It wouldn't be a contest. There'd be no winners. It was just a creative challenge to take the coldest, darkest, most worthless month of the year and use it for something good. And we were really delighted that first year. We had more than 220 bands sign up just from the Seacoast area of New Hampshire. And we ended up with 165 new albums that came in. And that really warmed our hearts.
Have you also done it? Are you a musician?
I am not a musician. I always get asked this question, and I always feel vaguely guilty, but I can't change the fact that I'm not a musician.
If he were a musician, I don't know if he would have come up with this.
I know, it does sound a little masochistic.
Well, why do you think people do it?
Well, I think, you know, it's sort of what you mentioned in your intro. It's that this deadline, even though there's a lot of pressure that comes along with the deadline, it's also very freeing. It forces you to try things that you might not have otherwise tried. And it also forces you to say, okay, this is pretty good. I've got to move on. And then the other thing that Dave said that I thought was really interesting was that it's also freeing in the sense that, you know, if you were to say, well, I'm going to make an album, there's this sort of weird implied thing that, like, why are you doing it? Are you doing it to become a successful musician? Are you doing it to make money? Are you doing it because you want to be loved? And all those things can feel like a real impediment to even starting a project. And this is for fun. It's a total excuse to try something and not feel like you're going to fail if it doesn't sell even 10 albums, you know?
You
can
so
just
it's
do
like
it.
A, like a prompt and there's no room for perfection.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so what does it look like? How does one actually sign up for it?
So what it looks like is basically a pretty bare-bones website. I mean, I think this thing probably hasn't changed much since they started it.
12 years ago?
12 years ago, exactly. It reminds me of early MySpace because you sign up, there's a little profile, you can stick a picture up there, there's a place to upload your music. There are some forums and blogs, so people who are doing it can sort of share tips or kind of be cheerleadery for each other because it is sort of a crazy thing. So it's a really cool kind of community.
After everything's turned in, we celebrate by having a listening party, and that's a really important part of it. So we play one song from every completed album from the geographic area and get everybody together so everybody can hear everybody else's work.
Well, you say the geographic area, and that's because it's kind of like expanded quite a bit beyond the borders of New Hampshire and New England, huh?
It sure has. Yeah, so the second year that we did it, you know, because it was based on a website, we just opened up the restrictions and said that anybody could participate. And we ended up with tremendous participation from all around the globe. We had more than 2,500 groups sign up from all seven continents. We even had a band from Antarctica.
The peripheral that left filler ruins you cracked up, busted on 12 show tours. Stares on the house like gasoline shadow.
have any famous bands ever done it? You know, a sort of American Idol style kind of launch?
No, I don't think you'll, you know, there's never been like an Aerosmith or a Kanye West who did it. But there's some really great professional musicians who take it as an opportunity, I think, to just play around. And I did find out that in 2007, Bob Boylan, who, if you're a public radio fan, you will know, used to direct All Things Considered for almost 20 years, I think. He's now host of All Songs Considered and creator of the Tiny Desk concert series. Well, he caught wind of RPM, and he actually did a story on it.
I'm a deadline kind of guy. When I direct All Things Considered, I pick the music you hear just minutes, sometimes seconds, before we need it. Ask our engineers. So I sent an instant message to Michael, the guitarist, and said, hey, want to make an album? There's this thing on the web. And he said, sure.
Anyway, he came out at the end of the month with his album. And little secret here, in case you ever wanted to know where Tiny Desk Concert came from, it is not just because of the Tiny
Desk.
It is named after his old band, Tiny Desk Unit. So this is...
A little bit of uncanny self-promotion there, Bob.
Exactly. Nobody would know. So this is from the album that they made for RPM called Sputnik Fell on My Birthday. And this is a track called Blue Jacket.
I'm dancing all alone, playing with the sound inside.
I feel like it's got a little bit of a Eno-esque quality.
I think you're being generous. So as established, when you're doing a full album in a month, you cannot hone anything to perfection. But you've decided you're going to follow one of the New Hampshire musicians throughout RPM 2017. So that's the month of February?
That is the month of February.
So cool. They choose the shortest month.
Yeah. Lots of people have a school vacation where their kids have to take a week off. So maybe that's...
time to disappear into the studio.
Exactly. Yeah, I skimmed the registration for this year. I sort of listened to a bunch of the tracks for people who had done it before, reached out to a couple people, and so let me introduce you to the person we're going to be following.
Hi, this is Rob.
Hi, Rob. This is Taylor from New Hampshire Public Radio. How's it going?
Hey, thanks for calling. It's going good.
Awesome, awesome. So do you go by RC or Rob?
I do. I go by RC Thomas because of the other Rob Thomas. the vastly more famous one.
Of course.
And it just makes it impossible if you're going to do anything on social media or the internet.
Yeah, so this is RC Thomas, Rob Thomas. He's been doing RPM for a couple years now. He lives just outside of Portsmouth, makes his living as a professional musician. He does like a mix of different types of bands, cover bands, original bands, jam bands. He does weddings, like a lot of musicians these days. He also throws out the occasional YouTube video.
Got a nice soulful voice.
Yeah. I listened to his stuff from last year, and he's got like a bunch of different tracks. They have different sounds. Like there's one has a bit of a Johnny Cash sort of feel to it. He's got a really nice like deep low voice when he wants to.
Gonna find a way tonight. Oh, gonna make it right.
Another track that kind of reminded me of Dave Matthews.
Waiting on a family line. Don't you wanna hear a lie?
Or maybe I'm thinking Hootie and the Blowfish.
Allman Brothers or something. And he's come back for another run. That's really encouraging.
Yeah, and he's coming back for another run at a tough time to be attempting RPM.
Yes, it's been an interesting year, only because I had to just recently move my entire recording studio out of my house. Because my wife and I are having a baby in May. So the recording studio room became the nursery. So I lucked out. A good friend of mine had a nice room in his basement. It just needed a little TLC.
So what's your plan? How often are you going to check in with him?
Well, what we're going to do is I'm going to go visit him a couple times throughout the month and sort of just see how things are going. He is going to record some diaries. We'll check back in a couple weeks and see how he's faring. Maybe one-third.
And see how often he wants to be keeping a diary for you when he's got to write a whole album.
Yeah, I know. I was like, okay, so you've got to write 10 songs or 35 minutes in 28 days and do all the work that I need you to do for my little radio story.
So. Okay, so he is a masochist.
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, producer Taylor Quimby is going to be following Portsmouth musician Rob, or R.C. Thomas, throughout the RPM Challenge this month. And you can find out more about the RPM Challenge, or you can even sign up for yourself. It starts tomorrow, so don't wait. If you've got an idea, this is the time. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org.
Talking about a giving low, betting on you know you see it, and you won't feel it.
Most of us loved painting and drawing and making as kids, but art became distant as we were paraded in front of paintings we were told were important on field trips to the museum, when we really wanted to be over at the Egypt wing looking at the mummies. We readily talk about movies and music and sports and politics, but when was the last time you got into a passionate conversation about a painting or a sculpture? Tamar Avishai is a former art historian who wants to make art less scary. Her Lonely Palette podcast focuses on one work of art across the historic spectrum per episode, and it's got people talking, landing on a few notable year-end playlists for 2016, including Wired magazine. Tamar Avishai, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So nice to have you here. First, a little on you. Can we call you a recovering art historian?
Yeah, that's something I've been trying to call myself. For a while, it was erstwhile art historian. But I still am. You know, by actually making the podcast, I'm realizing that I am an art historian. And it's nice to get back into it because it was a rocky relationship for a while.
Oh, good. Well, so we're not going to say anything bad about art historians. But I do wonder, you know, you describe your podcast as returning art history to the masses. Did art ever belong to the masses?
That's a good question. That's a good way of getting into it. Museums never really belonged to the masses until pretty recently. Artists and art historians have always had a bit of a frustrating relationship because the artists are the ones who are doing the work that is so subjective and really speaking to the context that they're coming from, especially modern art, which is what I'm really interested in. And art historians, their role is to take these stories and make them a little bit more universal, but also putting them kind of in a box that then is how it is taught and how it is presented, how it's displayed. The artists say, well, this is really personal and really subjective to me. And then you have art historians looking back and saying, yeah, but look at where you're coming from and look at where this art, what it leads to. And artists don't really want to be treated like that. But it's true. Both are true.
Why do you think people are afraid to talk about art?
Because they're really scared of being wrong. They're really scared of sounding stupid. I can't tell you how many times I've pointed a mic in somebody's face at a museum and asked them not to say anything about art history and just describe what they see, and nobody thinks that they're allowed to. No one thinks that if they don't have a background in art history, that they're allowed to actually speak about it intelligently.
Well, one of the things you do in the podcast is you put that on tape, people describing what they see. Here's a little edited bit of what people thought looking at a painting a number of people may have seen at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. John Singer Sargent's The Daughters of Edward Darley Boyd.
These four girls in this mostly dark interior, but they're illuminated by this, I don't know if the best word is delicious or juicy, morning light coming through.
It's almost like the four girls are acting their age. The two younger ones are like interested and the older ones are kind of more like not interested.
The Daughters of Edward Darley Boyd, if you haven't seen it, is a huge painting that's pretty dark. And you have these four girls. They go by age. So the youngest is little 4-year-old who's sitting on the floor in front. And then a little bit further back is an 8-year-old. And then in the back are two adolescents, one who's kind of looking out and one who isn't even acknowledging you at all, who's leaning against this huge, huge Chinese vase. And it is meant to be a portrait of these girls, but it's very awkward for a portrait. To have a portrait where you don't even see a girl's face because she's turned away from you goes against everything that you know, portraiture should be, and yet you learn so much more about who she is because she's not looking at you.
Well, I loved hearing some of the responses that you got from people, like the juicy light, you know, it was just lovely. And people are connecting with it and looking at it in a strong way. But these are people at a museum looking at a painting. It's much more challenging, I know, on the radio, mm-hmm. on a podcast, describing something. So how do you make it come alive, make it exciting?
There are two issues here. One is that trying to put the visual on radio is its own challenge. People are used to, though, using audio guides. And so that's something that I can work off of, that standing in front of a painting and listening to a podcast or a piece of audio is something that people are actually really familiar with. But getting them to talk and the way that they describe the painting is actually really fun. It took a little while to kind of perfect my pitch, because you have to both make them feel comfortable talking about art at all and then also kind of get good tape out of them. Because what I want from them is pure description. I don't want them to really analyze or interpret the object at all. I just want them to describe what they see. Hmm. Because if you are then listening, that's all you need to hear first and foremost is in your mind's eye, what are you looking at?
That was one of the funniest comments that I saw about your podcast from the radio host from Boston, Christopher Lydon. He said, this is what those snooze-a-thon museum audio tours should sound like.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear. This is a little clip from the episode from The Lonely Palette on Edward Hopper's room in Brooklyn.
Hopper plays with the qualities of stillness the way that Monet plays with the qualities of light. You never knew how many ways there were to be quiet, or expectant, or deep, until you walk up to a Hopper with footsteps that suddenly feel too loud and drop into it like a stone with no thump.
My guest is Tamar Avishai. She's an art historian turned podcaster and host of The Lonely Palette, which aims to make art history cool, one painting at a time. So that's a beautiful description. That's inviting to me. And that, I think it's that art historian language that sometimes throws me off or people off, you know, when they're talking about context. And even when you say modern art or a modernist, not everybody knows what that means. How would you define it?
I would define a modernist as actually more of a cultural historian than an art historian. And that's what I really loved about it. And that's why I got a little bit booted out of the art historian fold. And so I feel like what about modern art is so interesting. And modern art, it's modern art with a capital M. So that's, you know, kind of 1850 to 1950. You know, you've got what's going on in Europe is just fascinating. And you get into the 20th century and you have two world wars and you have the artists who are really learning how to kind of honor the first person perspective and what it means to really look at things and what it means to internalize a really complicated world through your very specific and subjective interpretation and your eyes. And you have all of these artists who are basically doing just that in a lot of really different, interesting ways. And so it can always come back to how an artist is experiencing the world. And I just find that time in history really interesting.
Well, it's a fascinating thing that comes up in your episode on Christian Boltanski's Lumière's Blue Square, Sylvie. First, if you could just briefly describe it.
It's an artwork that's very easy to walk by, even though it's really beautiful. It's rows and rows of light bulbs, but they're very dim and they have a little kind of bluish hue to them. And in the center, they're gridded really beautifully. And then in the center, you have a very grainy and kind of amorphous photo of a little girl that looks like it's a photo, but it's been like a photo that's been photographed over and over again so that it loses its integrity.
So it's funny when you're talking with people about it. I mean, this is one of those things that people think, oh, she looks like she must have been a Jewish refugee. It's of that period of time. Not really sure what the light bulbs are about. And that's one of those things that we have this lack of agency in considering art. You know, like if it's difficult to figure out, it must be really important. But in this case,
We assume that this is somebody, Sylvie, that he knew and loved and was disappeared like so many people in his own family during the war, he being Jewish. But we learn that our projections are totally off. Here you are from The Lonely Palette.
He's interested in how memory objectively works and, more importantly, how it fails us. Because the truth is, this is a photo he found at a flea market. We have no idea who she is. He has no idea who she is. And the entire narrative that we created around her, her life as a 1930s French schoolgirl cut short by Auschwitz, is completely projected onto her by us.
Tamar, what does that reveal to you?
That we are invited to participate in art a lot more than we think we are.
Well, I do see that with a Hopper painting or John Singer Sargent. You know, these are both portraits. They're both recognizable. They're accessible. Mm-hmm. But the experience that a lot of people have of art, especially contemporary art or installations in galleries, is not accessibility. In fact, deliberate inaccessibility. Like, we have to know the story in that case. Mm-hmm. How would you encourage somebody to view that differently?
I mean, first things first, see what the curator has said about it. So there's always wall text next to an object. As long as you understand that the story that the curator is telling is still a story of theirs, and that they are interpreting it for you, and then also hopefully giving you some room to interpret it yourself, then that's always a really good point of entry, and that's always a nice way of kind of starting that experience with the object. But then, you know, see if there's anything when you look at it that speaks to you. See if you see something the longer you stare at it. I opened an episode on Mondrian with a quote that my mom used to love to say that an art teacher of hers told her, that to really appreciate abstraction, you need a chair. That to really understand a Mondrian or a Pollock or a Rothko, you just have to sit with it for a while and really give yourself over to it. And every object in a contemporary gallery benefits from time with it and really kind of letting yourself approach it from every direction and try and understand why the artist wanted you to see this.
Or 15 minutes at a time in the case of Lonely Palette.
Yeah, or just listen to the podcast.
Tamar Avishai, art historian turned podcaster and host of The Lonely Palette. The podcast tagline, return art history to the masses one painting at a time. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And you can listen to episodes on Paul Gauguin, Jackson Pollock, Picasso, Monet, Degas, many more in just 15-minute episodes. There's a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Wherever you are listening to us today, we thank you for your time. Music in this episode came to us from Ari De Niro. There's loads more to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're also on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. You can also listen on your own time with the Word of Mouth podcast. And we encourage you to share it with friends or to rate it. Everything goes so much further when shared by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 on NHPR.